Welcome back to Introduction to International Politics. This lecture is about burning what you want in order to get more of it. With it, we move from the first big puzzle of the course, why isn't there more cooperation, to the second, why isn't there less conflict? I'm going to try to convince you over the next couple of lectures that this isn't a trivial question, even though conflict is, thankfully, pretty rare, as we discussed earlier in the course. It turns out that most attempts to answer this question fail in a big way because the conditions under which they expect war to occur are extremely common, but war itself is not. If the sorts of explanations for war that you probably found intuitively appealing walking into this course were sufficient, we wouldn't expect the overwhelming majority of international disputes and crises to end peacefully. But they do. Hopefully, after the next few lectures, you'll have a better sense of why most answers to this question are so problematic, and what answers might actually be more useful. If you turn to the first slide, I lay out there for you the two goals for this lecture. First, I'm going to introduce some new terms and concepts. Second, I'm going to demonstrate that war is inefficient. Precisely what I mean by that will become a little bit clearer in just a minute, but hopefully a lot clearer by the end of the lecture. On the second slide, you find three important terms that you've doubtless heard before. You may be used to using them slightly differently than I will here, though, so it's worth discussing them in some detail. First, let's talk about bargaining. In ordinary usage, this term has a pretty narrow meaning. It involves give and take and an explicit discussion of terms. It is most frequently used in economic context, where its usage is basically interchangeable with haggling. In this class, as in most of political science, we'll use it a bit more broadly, referring to any attempt to reach undisputed allocations through negotiation, fait accompli, or violence. Now let's unpack that a little bit. By undisputed allocations, I mean that bargaining ends when we reach the point where no one is making any serious attempt to change who gets what. This definition includes things you'd expect it to include, such as diplomatic negotiation, but it also includes actions that unilaterally alter the status quo, revising the facts on the ground in such a way that the other side will have no choice but to either live with it or take up arms, which, incidentally, is what the word fait accompli refers to, and also leaves room for using force to take what you want directly from the other side or to compel their acquiescence to your demands. In other words, bargaining is necessarily competitive and potentially coercive or even destructive. It includes just about all attempts to get more of what you want, not just those that involve a more or less polite discussion with genuine give and take. Next, let's clarify what we mean by war. Sometimes journalists or others use the term in a very legalistic sense. They'll casually mention that some country has technically, quote-unquote, been at war with its neighbor for 60 years because the two never signed a formal peace agreement. To my mind, that's overly cutesy, trying way too hard to be clever. Such a use of the term war contradicts everyone's intuitive understanding. If people ain't dying, no one's at war. Similarly, the Korean War was very obviously a war, even though President Truman chose to call it a peace action. We know that he did that precisely because he feared that the war would be less popular if he admitted that it was a war, which it pretty clearly was. There was nothing more to it than that. No complex legal reasoning, no diplomatic distinction. He's on the record, in private remarks that have since been made public, telling an aide that they had to call it a police action for that reason. I'm not going to play any such word games. In this class, we're going to call a spade a spade. If there's two or more groups engaged in violence for some serious length of time, we're not going to put any hard limit on that. Some wars have lasted a matter of days. In an organized way, we're not talking about a couple guys popping off a few rounds because they got freaked out by some strange noise, but someone in a position of authority ordering combat operations. In an attempt to achieve some desirable outcome, then it's a war. Finally, let's talk about what it means to say something is inefficient. This is a term that gets used a lot in economics, and it's used here in the same way. Inefficient outcomes are those that entail greater costs than would have been incurred had the actors done something else that would have gotten them to the same place, or one that's just as good. When someone tells you to use your time more efficiently, they're telling you to find ways to get the same amount done in less time, which is just another way of telling you that you're incurring greater costs than you need to. Well, I'm going to spend the rest of the lecture trying to convince you that when war occurs, that should be viewed as an inefficient outcome in the very same sense, because there are better ways of reaching undisputed allocations, better ways of bargaining. And since there are better ways, our task as observers of international politics is to explain why those weren't chosen. And that's going to be the focus of the next few lectures. So turn to the third slide and let's get into the details of the argument. We have two states, a challenger to the status quo called C, and a defender thereof who we'll call D. This crisis begins with C choosing the size of some parameter, X. And you'll see soon how consequential that is, because X is literally the share of the disputed good or goods that C will control if the game ends peacefully. I know that's a bit of a mouthful, but it's important to get this straight. If you write in your notes that X is what C wants, as many students in the past have done, you're missing the point. C wants everything. What C is choosing, strategically, is how much to try to get D to give up. So X might be a demand, delivered sternly, or a proposal, delivered nicely, or it might even be a fait accompli, such as a land grab. But however it is communicated, if D accepts it, either explicitly or implicitly, by doing nothing to reverse the change to the status quo, then C will control precisely X of what it wants, where X is a proportion. For example, if the disputed good is territory, then when X is 0.5, that means a peaceful resolution to the crisis would leave C with 50% of the territory that it wants. I'll talk a bit more soon about how to interpret X when we're not dealing with territory, or not just territory, but that's probably the easiest interpretation. And at least prior to 1945, the one that most international crises took place over. So again, the game begins with C choosing how big X is going to be, where X is how much of what it wants C will end up with if the game ends peacefully. It's not what C wants everything, but rather how much C, thinking strategically about what the likely reaction will be, tries to get D to give up. That is, the game begins with C issuing an ultimatum. The only other choice is made by D, who must decide whether to let C have X or fight C over it. As I've already said, and as you'd guess by the fact that I described C's action as an ultimatum, D can either accept, in which case the game ends peacefully, or reject, in which case there will be a war, presumably started by C, given that we're portraying them as the one that's dissatisfied with the status quo. But we're not going to worry about who attacks first. While that can have important political or military implications in a lot of cases, in terms of gaining some theoretical insight regarding the general puzzle I've laid out, it's not important. In terms of payoffs, we're going to keep things simple and assume that the amount of satisfaction each side gets from a peaceful outcome is determined solely by how much they get. That is, X is an objective measure, and we could, in principle, allow the amount of happiness that C gets from acquiring X of the territory to vary by multiplying X by some parameter that reflects the subjective importance of the issue to C. And in some more advanced models I've worked with, I've done that. But right now, we're going to keep the notation to a relative minimum. Note that if C gets X, and X is a proportion, then D is obviously left with the rest. And the rest is simply 1 minus X. In other words, if C takes 70% of the territory away from D, then D is left with 30%. If the two fight a war, their payoffs not only reflect how much each will get, but also the fact that war is costly. So we're going to give each side a payoff that's based on how much of the disputed good C is expected to wrest away from D through force, which is what W represents, but we're going to penalize them a bit too. That's where those C terms come in. More on that soon. I want to be careful here though, because students have often gotten these terms confused in the past. Do not put in your notes that W equals war. It doesn't. It is the share of the disputed good that C will acquire in war. It is how much C gets, not how much D gets. D gets 1 minus W. It is not the probability of war. Knowing the size of W tells us precisely nothing about whether war occurs or not. If you are asked a question on the final exam or on one of the homeworks about the probability that war would occur, do not tell me how big W is, because that is not the answer. I cannot say this more clearly. W is how much of what both sides want C will end up with if they fight. The cost terms are also easily misinterpreted. They represent how much utility the players lose when they incur the costs of war. They are measured on the same scale as X and W, not in terms of lives lost or money spent. In fact, the best way to think about CC and CD is that they tell us how much more territory C and D, respectively, would need to get in order to feel as though the costs of war weren't costly. So if CC is 0.2, then C, the challenger, would prefer getting 55% of the territory peacefully to fighting a war in which they expect to win control of 70% of the territory, because in that case they're only going to be as happy as if they got 50% of the territory thanks to the costs of war. Another way to think about this is, when you're fighting to repel an invasion of your homeland, you're willing to bear great costs, and so it might take a lot of fatalities to make you feel as though you'd lost as much utility as you would have if you'd surrendered an additional 1% of the territory. But when you're fighting to repel insurgents on the outskirts of a faraway country you maybe don't even care that much about, it wouldn't take that many of your own people dying before you'd start to feel as though maybe it would have been better to just let the insurgents grab a few more villages. So when you hear me talk about what happens as CC or CD increase, don't interpret that as what happens when wars become deadlier, because that's just one part of what determines how much utility states lose when they suffer the costs of war. It's an important part, I suspect, but still just one part. How important the issue is matters a lot too, and we'll take advantage of that later. Okay, so now we've talked about the basic structure of the model. C issues an ultimatum whose size is chosen strategically by C, and then D decides whether to give in or not. If they do, the game ends peacefully, and C acquires control of X, while D, who initially had everything, hence the 1, loses X. If D does not give in, the two fight a war, and C acquires W, but loses CC, while D loses W and CD. Before we talk about whether D would be willing to give in, let's just talk a little bit more about what X looks like in different cases, and what it means for C to ask for 55% or 32% or whatever of something other than territory. On the fourth slide, you have two figures. The one on the left shows you a range of values of X when C's point of dissatisfaction with the status quo concerns D's support for some terrorist group. It helps to remember that X is the payoff that C receives if the game ends peacefully with D getting 1 minus x. So another way to think about x, when literal proportions seem kind of odd, is that x tells us how close the outcome is to C's most preferred resolution of the crisis. When x is 1, C is as happy as C can be. When x equals 0, D is as happy as D can be. When x takes on values greater than 0, but less than 1, both sides are somewhat happy and somewhat unhappy. Just how happy or unhappy they are depends on how close to 0 or 1 x is. So in this case, D's most preferred outcome, which is C's least preferred, is for D to continue supporting the terrorist group, which I've called T to save space. And C's most preferred outcome, which would be D's least preferred, would be for D to combat T and let C come into their country and establish permanent military bases so they could go after T themselves if the group ever comes back. That covers x equals 0 and x equals 1. What about the intermediate outcomes? Well, we might say that when D ceases support of T, but takes no action to get rid of them, that brings C 25% of the satisfaction that they'd get from their most preferred outcome, so we'll call that x equals 0.25. And we could say that for D to not only cease support, but go and take on T, but not let C into their country, would be pretty good, especially if D doesn't make C give them money to support their counterterror operations, and so on. The numbers I've chosen here are arbitrary, of course. Depending on how much financial assistance D asked for, it might make more sense to represent that outcome with x equals 0.8 instead of 0.45. This is just to give you an idea of what it might mean for C to get x of what they want, rather than all or none of it, when the issue in dispute is something more abstract and hard to divide into percentages. Similarly, the figure on the right is there to help you think about what x might look like if the two sides are bargaining over multiple issues at the same time. Here, we've got a two-dimensional bargaining space, but we could easily apply similar reasoning to a three or four or n-dimensional bargaining space. And those two dimensions are the location and security of a border, where C would like to have more territory and also know that there won't be any attacks on their people originating from D's side of the border, or refugees streaming in, or illegal immigrants coming over, or whatever. Here, I've shown you indifference curves, lines that connect all the points over which the actors are indifferent because they bring an equal amount of utility, for just two arbitrarily chosen values of x, 0.15 and 0.6. The figure is telling us that C might be 15% as satisfied with the outcome as they would have been if they'd got everything they wanted, when the border's 30% as secure as it could be, but they have to relinquish all claim to the disputed territory, letting the border move closer to their capital. But they might also be 15% as satisfied as they could be if they get 30% of the disputed territory, meaning that the border is located a little closer to D's capital, while D does nothing to help secure the new border. Those two outcomes might bring the same amount of happiness, and so on. Similarly, there's a whole range of outcomes that could bring C 60% of the satisfaction they'd get if they had all the disputed territory and D did everything they could to secure the border. Note that if we have a large enough number of issues that are being bargained over at once, the bargaining space is sure to look pretty close to perfectly continuous, even if most of the issues are indivisible. I talk more in one of the optional lectures about what happens when the players find it really hard to compromise for symbolic or electoral reasons, which I think is a possibility worth worrying about to some extent. But if you're asking yourself, what if there's no way to divide things up? I think you're settling for an easy explanation for war. It is rare for states to disagree about just one issue. And even if they did, the side that gives in can demand compensation along some other dimension, making the bargaining space multidimensional, even if there is only one real issue of contention. It's hard for me to see how the literal impossibility of reaching intermediate outcomes, those that make both sides happier than their least preferred outcome, but not as happy as their most preferred outcome, could constitute a useful explanation for war. Let's now talk about what terms D would accept, which you can also think of as what types of demands they'd concede to, or what sort of fait accompli they'd be willing to let stand. What we want to know now, in other words, is when will D prefer letting the crisis end peacefully rather than going to war to avoid giving up X? Well, to answer that, we need to ask, when the utility D receives from a peaceful resolution to the crisis is at least as large as the utility D receives from war. And that's equivalent to asking when 1 minus X is greater than or equal to 1 minus W minus CD, since, as we said before, D gets 1 minus X when the game ends peacefully, and gets 1 minus W minus CD when the game ends in war. Through some simple algebraic manipulation, we can readily establish that 1 minus X is greater than or equal to 1 minus W minus CD whenever X is less than or equal to W plus CD. What does this tell us? Intuitively enough, that D will give in to any demand that doesn't ask for more than they'd give up anyway if they reject and go to war, in which case C would take W from them, and they'd feel like they lost another CD's worth of whatever it is that they're fighting over because of the cost of war. And so if we create a new term called X hat, we can say that D gives in to C's demand, or accepts their proposed division, or tolerates their fait accompli, whenever X is less than or equal to X hat. Another way of putting it is that X hat is the largest value of X that is still tolerable to D. Any value of X above that is going to make them fight, but they're willing to live with any X that is less than or equal to it. You might be wondering why we assume that D chooses peace when X is precisely equal to X hat. If they are literally no better off giving in than going to war, we have little basis for confidently asserting that they won't fight. True enough. But think about it this way. If we're saying that the occurrence of war is a puzzle, and our explanation for war is that sometimes D figures, ah, screw it, six of one, half a dozen of the other, well, that's not terribly insightful. I'd like to be able to give you a better explanation for war. And in fact, I both can and will in future lectures. I don't want to say that those explanations account for all possibilities, but it's not at all clear to me that many of history's wars were caused by total indifference. Now, turn to the sixth slide, because I'm about to discuss C's choice of X. Based on what we've already said, C can anticipate that asking for more than the most D is willing to give up, more than X hat, will provoke a war, while asking for anything up to and including that amount will end the crisis peacefully. If it turns out that C is willing to limit themselves by not going up past X hat, even though they definitely like more than that, they're obviously not going to pick a value of X that is less than X hat. In other words, if C knew that D would be willing to give up 50% of the territory without a fight, then C might or might not demand more than that. We haven't gotten far enough to say anything about that yet. But there's no way they'd demand less than that, a mere 10% of the territory. That wouldn't make any sense. In other words, though the model allows C to choose any value of X between 0 and 1, demanding everything, nothing, or any amount in between, and there's thus, in principle, an infinite number of choices to consider. Many of them are senseless. We can just rule out right away the possibility of C choosing any value of x that's less than x hat. If they want peace at all, they're going to want it on the best possible terms. And that's what they get when they demand precisely x hat, because as I said before, x hat is the largest value of x that is still tolerable to D. What about values greater than x hat? Again, there's a whole range of values there, but we can make our lives a lot simpler by applying a little logic. If C asks for more than D is willing to give up, whether they do so by a little or a lot, they're going to have a war on their hands. And the payoff they get from war does not depend on how big of a mistake they made. All it depends on is how much of what they want they're going to be able to take by force, and how much they're going to feel like they gave up as a result of incurring the costs of war. W and CC, in other words. So whether they set x equals x hat plus 0.0001 or x equals 1, it's all the same. That's all I mean when I say in the slides that C's utility for x1 is the same as it is for x2 for any x1 and x2 that belong to the set of values between x hat exclusive and 1 inclusive. Thus, we've established that the only question we need to answer is whether C is willing to settle for x hat or whether they'd rather provoke a war. There's an infinite number of possible x's they could choose, but we can either rule out or treat as identical all but one very precise value of x. On the next slide, we tackle the question of whether C would set x equal to x hat, which ensures a peaceful resolution to the crisis rather than provoking a war by demanding more than that amount. And they'll do so when the payoff they get from producing peace on those terms is at least as good as the payoff they get from fighting a war, which is itself true if, and only if, x hat is greater than or equal to w minus cc. And since x hat is, by definition, w plus cd, that means that c prefers x hat and peace whenever cc plus cd is greater than or equal to zero, which must be true. In other words, C prefers peace so long as war is costly, which it is. What does this tell us? As I discuss on the last slide, one big implication of this is that we can't claim to have explained war just because we've identified the issue in dispute. Knowing what is being fought over does not tell us why they're fighting over it. For example, it is often said that the cause of the U.S. Civil War was slavery. That's at best incomplete. Sure, anyone who has any sense of history, who isn't willfully denying some very well-established facts, will acknowledge that what the war was fought over was slavery. But slavery was a contentious issue in U.S. politics from the very beginning. I've heard historians say that war was inevitable from the outset, and the real puzzle is how the country made it to 1861 before war broke out. I actually think the puzzle is why there was ever a war, but we'll talk more about that in a future lecture. The point for now is that we can't just observe that two sides want different things and call that an explanation for why hundreds of thousands of people get killed in organized violence. There are other options, and they're usually chosen. Between 1816 and 1914, roughly 99% of all militarized interstate disputes, incidents involving either a threat to use force, a show of force, or the actual use of force, ended short of war. And since 1945, disputes have been even less likely to escalate to war. In other words, the overwhelming majority of international crises end peacefully. It is nearly always the case that states find ways to resolve their disagreements without going to war. Any explanation for war that can't be reconciled with that fact is no explanation at all. And sadly, non-explanations are probably all you've ever heard. We'll talk more about what real explanations for war, ones that allow us to account for the fact that peace often prevails, in future lectures. But for now, I'll just close with an observation that sums up everything so far. To explain why a war is fought, we must explain why the parties failed to resolve their disagreement through a more efficient means. Thank you. That concludes this lecture.